Which was told, you know, this your assignment is to investigate new analytical techniques that come out and find out where these things can make a contribution to our problems.
Must have been an expensive device. I mean,
the first NMR spectrometer was about $30,000, but that was in early 1950s, so that would be about the same price that you're paying now in 1950 dollars. I think there's about a 10-to-1 ratio, mm-hmm. maybe even more than that, but it's at least 10-to-1. So that would make it a $300,000 instrument now, which is about what people are paying for a good modern spectrometer,
mm-hmm.
which is probably 100,000 times more sensitive than that first instrument, you know, is working at a field strength at least 10 times as high and probably nearly 20 times as high.
Hmm.
And so we have this enormous improved dispersion. The line widths have narrowed down by a factor of 10 in addition, and then the sensitivity's gone up by about 100,000. And you're getting that for the same price in terms of current dollars as you got that first primitive piece of equipment that, you know, when I think about what I worked with, I wonder how I ever solved any problem.
So then it was at the time of that first instrument's delivery, it was very competitive with the mass spectrometer. I mean, it was cheaper than a mass spectrometer.
It was cheaper, but it wouldn't do anything like
what
they needed to do along the lines that a mass spectrometer could do.
Right.
So it wasn't competitive. It was complementary.
Right.
It got information that you couldn't get from a mass spectrometer, but mm-hmm. which they didn't know whether they needed yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for the applications laboratory was the second machine. Were they taking orders to deliver more NMRs?
Yes, they were definitely taking orders anywhere they could get them. And one of the next machines went to Shell Development over across the bay mm-hmm. in Henryville here. And they were they made very good use of it in a very similar way to the Humboldt Oil Company did for then was acquired by Exxon.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's Shell and Exxon both doing research. And there were some other spectrometers that were made that were not high resolution, and Varian was willing to make anything to find out where the markets were, and so we made some things which looked at much broader lines, and they even used those to look at oil well core borings
mm-hmm.
To see the difference between oil and water in them, because you could resolve that. And that turned into a major business also.
Mm-hmm.
Not for spectrometers, but ultimately they put the NMR down the well bore, and they could tell where there was oil and where there was water.
Hmm.
So then they knew where to try to get production.
I wanted to ask you about in the first years that you were at Varian. Your impressions of some of the early figures in the firm. You know, you're mm-hmm. you're coming, well, I guess 4 years after it gets incorporated, you know, mm-hmm. 5 years after
right.
this
yeah.
idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you could tell me about your experience with the Varian brothers in the early days.
Yeah, Varian was a very unique place because the Varian brothers were very unique people. Russell Varian was a visionary. He looks like a visionary. He looks like a prophet or something, you know, and a guy who's out in the poppies somewhere. But he had this very keen, intuitive, and creative mind, which could see all kinds of possibilities. And he had invented the klystron tube, Sigurd Varian was the practical nuts and bolts guy. He ran the machine shops and made sure that all of that kind of stuff was done, and was a very down-to-earth person. He had been an airline pilot in the days when they flew Ford Tri-Motors to South America, and he had put in a career then that way, but he ultimately joined his brother to found Varian. They both put money into it with about six or eight other people, I believe. There's the whole story is told in some book. So these people had started the company, and Russell had made it clear their real aim was to make NMR instruments. And it turned out, of course, that after a couple of months of operation, they were running out of money and there was nothing to sell. Mm-hmm. No income coming in. And it would have been a very short-lived company, except that Sputnik went up. They realized they knew how to make klystron tubes, that there would be a big demand for high-frequency transmission, mm-hmm. and that klystrons would be necessary and that the government would be looking for them. And so they went to Washington and got some tube development contracts, which paved the way for, probably the first five or more years of the company's existence. In fact, maybe longer than that, maybe 10 years. Mm-hmm. Tubes carried the whole load, or nearly the whole load. And this led to quite a lot of controversy within the company. The people making tubes says, why do we have this useless instrument division hanging here and holding our profit, eating up our profits?
Mm-hmm.
But Russell was quite firm in that our objective is to make scientific instruments. And of course, now that we're so well established as a leading maker of klystron tubes, we'll go on doing that too. We have now two divisions, the klystron division, the tube division, and the special products division, which turned into the instrument division.
Right.
But we're always a lot of competition between the two for the funding, and a little grumbling on the part of the people who were really bringing in the money. Later on, many years later on, Varian divested itself of the tube business because it wasn't able to make the same profits anymore. And for quite a while before that, the NMR people had been saying, why are we pouring money into this corporation which is supporting this failing tube operation? So, in the end, it all worked out, but it kind of proves the value of diversifying and having a multi-divisional company. So that was where that all went. Ultimately, in fact, it proved no longer to be desirable to have a multi-divisional company because the individual divisions had reached the point where they were all very self-sufficient, and they were not synergistic at all. They didn't have anything in common in marketplace or technology or anything. Maybe they could all use circuit boards, but that was about it. And so the company actually split into three companies. Instead of three divisions and Varian Associates with a corporate umbrella, they dissolved Varian Associates into three individual Varian companies, one of which and by then they had divested themselves of the tubes, but what was left was the instruments in one division, the medical instrumentation, which developed over a number of years into linear accelerators for cancer treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the medical division. And then they had gone into vacuum work, which led to them getting into making the silicon chips for integrated circuits for microprocessors.
Mm-hmm.
And so Varian makes the machines that make the chips and impregnate them with ions to be later converted into microprocessors. And so there are three separate businesses with almost no overlap at all, It made no sense then to have the extra cost and unwieldiness of a big corporation sitting over that. Hmm. So about 3 years ago, the corporation was dissolved, and the three companies are now three corporations, which are independent of one another.
So there's Varian Medical Systems.
And Varian Inc.
Varian Inc., which is NMR.
Instruments. And Varian Systems, which is the implant, ion implantation.
Okay.
And so the process went the other way, finally.
Right.
It's a kind of a complete story.
Right.
You know?
A complete arc.
Yeah.
Who was in charge of... So the applications laboratory was, of course, in the instrument division. And was it... Who was it... who was heading up
it? It reported to Martin Packard, who was the research director for a number of years, for several years. I reported directly to Martin Packard. And so I was in the research department, but I was running the application laboratory. Then... After about 5 years, I think, Emery Rogers came along, and he was appointed sales manager. And Emery immediately had a vision of expanding the sales force and, you know, doing all the things that you do to market products, because mm-hmm. by then we really did have a line of products. And so he wanted to transfer the application laboratory to marketing, and Martin was perfectly agreeable to that because there was plenty to do in research. And so I then reported to marketing after that. And Emery and I were guys who, again, had an instant affinity for each other. We just understood each other perfectly always. And we worked together beautifully, and we traveled together a lot. We went to see customers. One time we went on a trip, and we went to New Mexico on our way back, stopped in New Mexico because our representative there had said that we used sales reps at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Our representative said, I'll have an audience for you. When we got there, it turned out his most of his contacts were with the electronic engineering IEEE, I think it was
right.
called, that institute or that organization. And so there were two people who came to the lecture, and there were two lecturers. We gave them our talk, and they listened, and they enjoyed it, but of course they were not really potential customers. And maybe they told somebody something, but anyway, wherever we went, we would talk. And we did a lot of traveling, and sometimes we got very good audiences, and then gradually, with time, we got invited to places independently. We didn't have to go through our reps
mm-hmm.
or our local salesmen, and began attending trade shows, and... became known, and then of course it was off to the races at that point. But Emery Rogers was a key person in actually building up the demand for these products by running an aggressive marketing operation, and he worked very closely with me because I provided all of the scientific data that we could use to back up our claims and
mm-hmm.
make literature interesting to people. If you don't talk about people's problems and show them a problem that is something like the one they've got, they don't have any real way to understand what you have to offer them. And that proved to be a very effective way to promote this kind of a product.
When did that switch take place from?
Well, probably... I don't remember actually, but it probably was around 1955 or 6, maybe 56.
Pretty early on.
Yeah, after several years, we started delivering instruments in 1953. It was at least 3 years. It might have been 4 or 5 years that we finally formalized it as a marketing operation.
Do you think that was unusual for an unusual organizational situation in terms of the instrument business? I haven't really heard of having a laboratory that was really doing some pretty forward-looking research within a marketing department.
I think up to that point, almost all instrument companies were based on techniques that had been around for many, many years, and a lot of the research had been done on them, but their instruments were primitive in many ways, and the electronic techniques had limited that. They didn't have the advances that occurred during the war. And yet the instruments had been around in much more unwieldy shapes, mm-hmm. and a lot of research had been done. So people knew what could be done, but all the machines were kludges, and they wouldn't be very suitable to anybody to buy and try to operate. And then it became clear that, hey, we could make these machines much more compact and use electronics to do things that had been done mechanically,
right.
and so on, and they would become usable by the average chemist who's really only interested in the instrument to get an answer to do what he really is doing, and he doesn't want to spend a lot of time having to master the operation of a complicated instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so most of those people already, those companies had a product line that wasn't selling in large volume, but they knew what it would do and what kind of problems it would solve, and they didn't have to do a lot of research of their own. They had to demonstrate their instruments.
Right.
They had demonstration places. They didn't have laboratories that tackled new problems for
mm-hmm.
customers. And so I think the idea of an application laboratory that would either do brand new research just to explore what could be done and publish it so people who had those problems would see the potential, or we would take your sample and run it for you and see whether or not the information that we generated overlapped any of your problems.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, probably was about the first time that was done.
Yeah, I was just trying to think of another example of that, and actually the only one that came to mind was I've seen a similar sort of thing with atomic absorption,
mm-hmm.
spectrophotometry.
Yeah.
But then again,
that's after NMR.
Right.
Yeah,
and then I just realized, oh, Tektron. Tektron,
yeah.
Variant.
Right. Eventually bought. Yeah.
Right. So it's mm-hmm. it's a yeah. Variant model, but I think mm-hmm. later it's picked up by other companies.
And gas chromatography came along later, and that was also then they set up laboratories and would demonstrate solving problems.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't too much research that needed to be done because gas chromatography is a pretty straightforward technique, and it's more how you do it than what you do.
Now, Russell Varian certainly had this amazing commitment to developing NMRs as a tool, and a tool for chemical analysis, really. I mean, looking
that's what he saw
patent.
When he saw the original work, he thought, particularly when he saw the three peaks from the ethyl alcohol. But even before that, when he saw that each nucleus had a magnetic moment,
right.
you could analyze things, he thought, we need to make it to get the patent on this thing, and then we need to develop it. And I don't think he had a particular plan as to how it ought to be developed, but when he saw what we were doing after I got there and we set up the application lab, then he often came around and looked over my shoulder, and or I would see him in the cafeteria at lunchtime, and we'd sit across from each other and talk about what we were doing. And he kept abreast of what was going on, and he never came in and said, you ought to be doing this or that. He seemed to be quite with it, that it was going the way he had hoped it would.
So For how long was he actively at the helm? I guess I'm wondering.
He died in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
He had a heart attack in Alaska on an Alaskan vacation. He died in 1960. So he founded the company in 1948.
Hmm.
He was the head of the company for 12 years. And he was active right until he had his heart attack. But he wasn't always in good health. It was clear that, you know, he was in a precarious state the last few years. But he was very much involved in all of the technical affairs, and he had a sense of business. I mean, he was an entrepreneur. He was a guy who felt that if you do things, you should do it for a profit, and you should plow back 10% of your earnings into research so that you will have a better product than your competitors. Then you can charge more for your product than they can, and you will be able to have money to continue to stay ahead of them, rather than just sink into the mass of competitors and have your little share of the market. And Varian has always gone after market share and been aggressive at developing new products. And that really was the philosophy of Russell Varian. And of course, many of us who worked in that business believed in that philosophy, and so we kept going with it.
Well, that was sort of my next question, which was, while he was at the helm, certainly, you know, the people in the instruments division were sort of realizing his initial idea for the company, so you probably felt pretty secure about you'll get the resources that you need, you know, even though it's coming over. Maybe it wasn't, the instrument division wasn't self-sufficient yet and was still, you know, getting supported by the tubes business. So in 1960, was there a change? Was that commitment was sort of institutionalized into the company? You know, this pursuit
I think it was pretty much institutionalized that people who were in the corporate management of the company expected that the budget would include R&D funding. And, of course, we were expected to make a profit, but and I don't know when the division actually first became profitable, but I think it probably took till about 1957 or 8 or something like that. It might have been a relatively low profit business until we came out with the A60, which came out in 1961. And the A60 was a huge success, and definitely, I think from that time on, the division certainly made a profit. We may have made profits earlier than that, maybe as early as 57 or 58.
Okay. Right. So what was the growth like of the applications laboratory itself, let's say in the first, up until the introduction of the A60, let's say? You know, did it start out as just you, or?
It started out with just me, and I worked by myself for probably about a year, and then I got a person to work with me, a woman who was the wife of a mathematician at Stanford. Her name was Virginia Royden. Hal Royden was her husband, who is a professor of mathematics at Stanford. And she worked with me in the lab, and I provided most of the planning and set the direction of what we would do, And then she helped me to actually make those things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Sample preparation, the operation of the machine. I've got a great picture of the two of us running the machine, because it was a two-person operation for a while in the early stages. One person was adjusting the magnet, and the other one was watching all the other dials and things. It was a nightmare to run the early models of the instrument. So she was very helpful in making it possible to run everything. And she also was trained as a chemist. I think she had she may have had her doctor's degree. I'm not sure, she could interpret the spectra, and so we worked together on, you know, trying to figure out what can we do with this thing. And I think she also attended some of the trade shows when we started doing that. She would come along and participate. But then eventually, for one reason or another, retired. I'm not sure, maybe she had kids. Eventually I had to go out and find a person to work with me, because one guy really couldn't do the whole job.
Right.
I had to travel quite often, and so there had to be somebody there to keep the show on the road. And we were also having more and more success at solving problems, and so there were lots more samples coming in, and we were trying to keep up with those. So I looked around, and I got in touch with a guy who was a graduate student at the University of Washington, working for his PhD, but he was in financial hole, and he really couldn't keep going to school. He needed to get a job. And so of all the people that I interviewed, he seemed to be, to me, to be the most qualified person. And his name was Roy Johnson. Leroy Johnson. And Roy Johnson ultimately turned out to be quite a strong figure in the NMR field, in the instrument business. He worked for me until I left the company briefly for about a period of a few years in 1969, and Roy Johnson took over the application laboratory, ran it quite successfully for, I don't remember now, about 4 years, 3 or 4 years. Then he left Varian with several other people who were leaving Varian, because people do get kind of caught, stuck in a niche, and they have desires to do more things, but the company doesn't always meet what the company thinks
mm-hmm.
is needed. And so Varian had a number of spin-offs from its operations, some of which turned out to be quite important things, like spectrophysics, which is the first commercial laser company, turned out to make huge fortunes for people. And Roy Johnson left with a few other people, and they formed a company called Spectrospin, I think. And then that company got absorbed by another company that made computers, which was a company in Wisconsin. I can't remember the name now. I probably can think of it. They were absorbed by this other company, and then they started making NMR spectrometers. And then eventually that operation was getting into trouble. They were one of the minor companies, and they didn't have a good market position. And that got absorbed by General Electric. And so Roy Johnson put in the major part of the last part of his career with General Electric as head of their application laboratory across the bay, and did a very good job there, and was really very highly regarded in the NMR field. At meetings, he gave excellent talks. He was a good speaker. and very solid guy in conceiving and describing experiments, and developing new NMR experiments and trying out new experiments. So he had a good career, but he started with me about probably around 1956 or 7, and was there until 69. So he spent a long time there and was my right-hand man. And I really relied very heavily on him. And we published some things together. He was a good contributor to our internal bulletins, articles about various accessories and applications, many of them bear Roy Johnson's name. We had a couple of other application chemists along the way who sort of worked under Roy, but we never had more than three or at most four people in the application laboratory. Later on, the application laboratory branched out into a wider range of instrumentation. Varian began to put more emphasis on solid-state samples instead of liquid samples, and which isn't high resolution, but it still made sense to do your applications all in one group.
So right.
The current application laboratory now has five or six people, I guess, working in it. They now have imaging laboratory. They have the solids. They have the high resolution. They have the very high field, high resolution instruments, the state-of-the-art biochemical instruments, and then they have the ordinary vanilla flavor mid-range field strength instruments that are the basis of the organic chemistry,
right.
Instruments used by organic chemists. So now it's a group of maybe 6, 8, 10 people, somewhere in that range. But it's never been a really big operation, but with time now, as the market has grown and grown and broadened, it has gotten to be a bigger thing. But the largest number that I ever remember was about 3-4 people, maybe, in one time.
Well, with the, you and Roy Johnson then were essentially the lead. You had the lead contacts between the broader, you were the people interfacing with the broader chemical community, yeah. Along with Emery Rogers. And with these early technical bulletins, the application advertisements, if I could call them that, they do start to bring in you do start to develop contacts, right? People sending you samples to
Absolutely.
Solve problems.
And we encouraged people to send samples, and we particularly tried to work with leaders in
right.
the field, because they are the people who are the ones who are more progressive. They are leaders because they keep their eyes open, they look around, they try to do